You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So it is my great honor tonight both to introduce and then to interview Helen MacDonald, who is the author of H is for Hawk, a book that I find incandescently beautiful and utterly original, and I know I'm not the only one in this room. The book is the winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize, the most prestigious nonfiction award in the United Kingdom, as well as the Costa Book of the Year for 2014. The poet Andrew Motion calls MacDonald's book both elegy and celebration, and certainly it's an example of some of the most distinguished writing about the relationship between humankind and the environment. Helen MacDonald is a writer, a poet, an illustrator, historian, nationalist, not a nationalist, let me try that again. A naturalist, she wouldn't appreciate that, and an affiliated research scholar at the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. She's also the author of a book about falcons, published in 2006, and as well a beautiful debut collection of poems, which we also have on sale tonight, rooted in the natural world, called Shaler's Fish. She's worked as a professional falconer, assisting with the management of raptor research and conservation projects. In fact, the first thing I was going to say was welcome to this very different light of Southern California. You are a woman of the northern climes. So
I guess so. Yeah, it's a bit of a shock. These great slabs of sunlight falling on me.
You doing okay?
I like it actually.
It's really doing okay.
When I started the tour, they started me off in Miami, and I thought I'm going to hate Miami. I like frost and hillsides and winter trees. And I got there, and there was the sort of humid skies and lizards on the sidewalks and thunderclouds, and I'm like, quite like this. Take up golf or something, you know.
You know, since I started rereading your book for this interview, hawks have been coming to me. I live in Silver Lake, not far from here, and I swear, just in the last week rereading, so you're summoning them. Your very book is summoning them. As a child, you were obsessed both with birds and with falcons.
So there was one thing I'm still embarrassed about in that book, and that is that the confession that when I was small, I used to try and sleep with my arms.
That's one of my favorite things in the whole book.
Yeah. Yeah, I was obsessed with hawks. I mean, I really, really did want to kind of be one. And then when I discovered I couldn't be one, which took a while, I realized there was a thing called falconry and that I could live with birds of prey. And I told my parents, I'm going to be a falconer when I grow up. And I think my mother pretty much only twice said to me, are you sure you wouldn't rather be a lawyer?
So no obsession with horses?
Well, I'm very allergic to most mammals.
Do you think otherwise you might have channeled into that more, but it was towards birds that you first...
Yeah, it was always birds.
Always birds.
Always, always birds. I don't know why. In the book, I speculate that it might be due to the fact that I had a twin brother who died just after he was born. I didn't know about this till I was 18 or 19. It made perfect sense. Mm. I always felt half of me was missing in a really deep way, which sounds so kind of dramatic, but I think that sense of birds conjuring transcendent and flight and returning, I mean, it's very much caught up in how falconry is for me, and maybe that's part of it.
There's a beautiful excerpt, I thought, if any of you have read the audiobook or listened to the audiobook of Helen, know it's what a treat it is to hear her read, so I've picked several passages throughout this conversation that I hope she would read. And the first one is this description of yourself as the child obsessed with hawks.
Indeed, indeed.
On 27.
It's 27, isn't it? Here we go. I don't normally read this bit out. I was a scrawny, too tall child with ink on my fingers, binoculars around my neck, and legs covered in plasters. I was shy, pigeon-toed, knock-kneed, fantastically clumsy, hopeless at sport, and allergic to dogs and horses. But I had an obsession. Birds. Birds of prey, most of all. I was sure they were the best things that had ever existed. My parents thought this obsession would go the way of the others, dinosaurs, ponies, volcanoes. It didn't, it worsened. When I was six, I tried to sleep every night with my arms folded behind my back like wings. This didn't last long because it is very hard to sleep with your arms folded behind your back like wings. Later, when I saw pictures of the ancient Egyptian falcon-headed god Horus, all faience and turquoise and with a perfect moustachial stripe below his wide, haunting eyes, I was stricken with a strange religious awe. This was my god, not the one we prayed to at school. He was an old man with a white beard and drapes. For weeks, in secret heresy, I whispered, "Dear Horus," instead of "Our Father," when we recited the Lord's Prayer at school assemblies. It was a suitably formal address, I thought, having learned it from writing birthday thank you notes. Hawk habits, hawk species, hawk scientific names. I learnt them all, stuck pictures of raptors to my bedroom walls and drew them over and over again on the edges of newspapers, on scraps of notepaper, on the margins of my school exercise books, as if by so doing I could conjure them into existence. I remember a teacher showing us photographs of the cave paintings at Lascaux and explaining that no one knew why prehistoric people drew these animals. I was indignant. I knew exactly why. But at that age, I was at a loss to put my intuition into words that made sense even to me.
Mm. And that's a very telling phrase, a loss to put my intuition... Yes, please. Because you make so palpable throughout the book things that you don't quite understand, things that are ahead of yourself. I mean, that sense, I think... You carry it through the book. It's a beautiful theme.
It's a book about being an unreliable narrator, basically, if you want to go for the full literary kind of thing there. I mean, at the beginning of this book is a woman who's been wrecked by grief, and she doesn't know very much. She really doesn't. I mean, she's a bit of an idiot because she's never faced a situation before, as we all do at some point in our lives. And the book traces her slow kind of series of disasters and eventual workings out of some quite big things about life and death that we all have to work out. But even at the beginning, I wanted to get that sense that we're all a bit of an idiot, particularly when we're children. You know, there's a bit where I talk about my first reading of the book by T.H. White called The Goshawk and how much I hated it, how much I hated that man and hated what he did to that bird. And I say there's a line, I think I said something like, I was secure in the self-confidence and self-righteousness that is the refuge of the very small. It's only when you don't know very much that you can be really self-righteous, I think.
So you had this fascination with hawks, with falcons, but not a goshawk.
Never.
Because the literature, and you read the literature, had spelled out to you. Tell us a little bit, like, why wouldn't you, you know, why was the common sense that that's not what you would want to do?
Yeah, it's really cool, actually. So I became a falconer. I got a kestrel when I was 12, which is ridiculously early.
Got a kestrel when I was 12.
Yeah, exactly. She was called Amy and slept on my bedroom bookcase. We put newspaper down underneath to stop, you know, to catch the mutes, as we call them in falconry. I flew peregrine falcons, I flew ger falcons. Mm. Like, I did a lot of falcons. I never wanted to train a goshawk. They had a reputation as being, yeah, I mean, pretty much...
Spooky, pale-eyed psychopaths?
Yeah, the Christopher Walkens of the bird world. I did an event in Westport a few weeks ago, and a few days ago, and I discussed this thing that they were kind of the Christopher Walkens of the bird world, and everyone went really quiet.
I totally get it, totally get
and,
it.
And everyone came up to me afterwards and said, "He lives here. He's a really nice man. He's not a psychopath." And I'm like, I know. But yeah, they have this, they're kind of like Apache helicopter gunships. They're incredibly powerful, highly strung, like psychopathic racehorses, you know. They're very, very difficult to train and very, very bloodthirsty.
And among the many words, this book is teaches you so much vocabulary. It's quite amazing. There's a word for just someone who trains particularly goshawks and sparrowhawks, the ostringer. So you are an ostringer. But it's not a very complimentary term used colloquially, which I thought was fascinating. Tell us about that.
Right, as you can imagine, in England, falconry is kind of a bit class-inflected. There's a lot of class going on. And in your early modern Europe, too, it was this huge kind of signifier of, like, it's different. It's like fishing. There's very kind of posh fishing, and then there's not posh fishing. And falconry's like that. Okay, so if you're really rich and wealthy and an aristocrat, you fly falcons. You need a lot of space and land, and they catch delicious game birds for you, and you kind of show off a lot because it's kind of aerial ballet. Goshawks are for people who've not got much land or money but want to catch a lot of food to feed their family. Mm. And Yeah, there's a wonderful sort of early modern author called Gaston de Lamine from France, who says, if you want to insult someone, you just say, look, there goes an Ostringer, you know. They were kind of, yeah.
But they were also, they needed to be solitary, right?
Yeah, very solitary.
So there's someone that's not too socially adept, right?
Right. With the falcons, you can go out on horseback with your retinue. You know, it's a very sociable thing. Goshawkers tend to be running around swearing, getting covered in mud and going through hedges. And, you know, I mean, it really is a very... I mean, you're making me feel quite embarrassed now about this.
You're a graceful Ostringer. But it was your grief at losing your father that propelled you into your decision to find a goshawk to train. And maybe we could bring up the picture of early days of training Mabel.
If only I knew I'd been LA, that photograph, I would have brushed my hair. this is actually literally the first morning that I got Mabel. This is in my house, my college house in Cambridge. My college did not know I had a hawk. I didn't tell them. And I'm sitting there, and you can see on the floor a vinyl tablecloth that's green with white spots. When I put the perch on it, and when she used to sort of make mess, I'd wipe it up. And I was laughing because quite recently I went to my brother's and his wife's house for dinner, and they'd bought this new tablecloth, and it was that one. And I just... I found it quite hard to eat off it. So this is really sweet for me, this picture, because this is Mabel when she was a baby. She still has blue eyes, and she is in the state of a hawk that is coiled to spring. And I think at this point she'd heard a camera shutter go off. It's an automatic photograph.
Did you know? I mean, did you make the connection immediately? I mean, it wasn't like, my father died, I'm getting a goshawk. I mean...
No, it's not one of those, I was sad, I got a cat, and then I got
right.
books. No. I think following a big loss, a lot of your decisions, well, mine certainly, took place on a level way below conscious or logical examination. I was drawn towards goshawks in a way. I dreamt of them every night. They were all I could think about. And I think there were reasons for that. One of them was the writing of, when I read the T.H. White book when I was small, I realized that somehow it was a book about a man running away from something, running away from something difficult circumstances to train a hawk. I didn't realize then that it was to do with his sexuality and he felt very unloved. But also, yeah, I mean, goshawks are very, very wild and inhuman, and they're full of kind of this powerful, it's not rage, but it's predatory power. And I guess I thought, you know, I don't want to be really me anymore. I want to be more like one of these things.
So as you're... When we think about the characters in your book, so Mabel is a character. Mabel, you are a character. And the goshawk, the book itself, is practically a character. It's sitting there on your shelf.
Yeah.
You kind of, you know...
Yeah, I didn't want to read it. I didn't even want to look at it. Because I knew it was a bit close to the bone, I think.
And T.H. White, but he was there. He was haunting this discovery. So when it's a strand, part of the structure of your book is that you're weaving this whole other story. And it's like a counter-narrative to how you're... training Mabel. Tell us a little bit about that, about the antithesis of these different methods.
Right, so...
When was he doing this?
He tried to train a goshawk in 1936, so it's also a war book. I mean, it's a book about the oncoming war. It's a book about fascism to some extent as well. I mean,
I just called you a nationalist by mistake.
I heard that. I was like,
so
I'm going to just choose to ignore that.
Sorry.
I said a very rude word on stage at AWP the other day, so I feel that that's nothing in comparison.
I know.
I'm not going to.
I was there.
It was a mistake. So he you know, this goshawk, in some ways for White, was the apotheosis of kind of that irrational fascist will to power. And in civilizing this hawk in the 30s, it was kind of as if he was kind of fighting the war against this bird to try and civilize fascism. But at the same time, he was deeply drawn to this hawk because it was all the things that deep down he wanted to be. He was he had a horrendous upbringing. I mean, it's heartbreaking, some of the stories.
He was a gay, closeted man.
Right.
And this was part of what he was working out with this hawk.
With this hawk, yeah.
Which may not seem immediately obvious, but you make quite a case for it.
Yeah, I mean, there are these weird bits in his notebooks that never got published where he talks about the hawk was obsessed with having its tail touched, and it was probably a pansy. I mean, very strange stuff.
But backtrack a little. We need to tell people who T.H. White was.
Right, let's talk about T.H. White.
Because you probably know him in another context.
Have any of you read The Sword and the Stone and The Once and Future King? Yeah, loads of you. It's weirdly much more popular in this country than it is in England.
Hugely popular, yeah.
Yeah. It's an incredible retelling of the Arthurian legend for the 20th century, and a book again about war and about power. And but before he wrote it, he trained this hawk and tried to write a book about it, which he never published.
Never published it?
Until many years had gone past, and the manuscript was found literally beneath a... He was using it to sort of plump up his sofa.
Wow.
And his publisher was like, "What's that?" And he pulled out this thing and said, "What's this, Tim?" And Tim was like, "Oh, I made a really bad job of that." And the publisher took it away and read it and said, This is hot stuff. You know, we're going to publish this." And Tim had to try and beg him not to, because he felt it made him look like a fool, because he'd realized by then that this was a book about a man trying to do something. He didn't know how to train a hawk. He didn't have really any of the tools to know how to do it properly or care for anything, including himself. And it's a very poignant book and a very sad book.
There was, you talk a lot in the book about, landscape is also almost a character in the book, the landscape that you train the hawk in, the old England that the hawk represents. Mm. And that was very true for White as well. I mean, the hawk represented this lost time. And there's a beautiful passage. I wondered if you could read where he's walking through the countryside.
Before I do, I just want to sort of pick up on the beginning of that question you asked about White, because I think I've probably failed to answer it completely. I got so excited about talking about him. And that is the sense of his story and mine being antitheses. I didn't want it to be a book that was about how I could train a hawk and he couldn't. I wanted it to be a book about how we both made the same mistake. And we can talk a bit about that later, but we were both doing, even though I think, you know, I had better falconry skills and my life wasn't so miserable in many ways. I mean, I'm generally happy with myself. We both made this terrible error about how we relate to the natural world. So we'll get back to that. This is the bit about the...
Walking through the countryside.
And this is where I do the creative thing. And I put myself inside T.H. White's head, which was a really interesting thing to do. And I went to the T.H. White archives in Texas, and I read all of his unpublished works and manuscripts and tried to sort of speak in his voice, which is a very weird thing to do and really interesting to try and do. Anyway, okay. The cloud base is low today. It does not matter. He is not flying today. He is walking. He is walking with his hawk, and he and Goss have traversed 5 fields to get here. And now he stands by the ruins of the chapel of St. Thomas the Martyr. Once it was a chapel, then it was a house, and now it is a ruin, a great collapsing carcass of stained ironstone. Lintels sag over windows and doors blocked with laths and limestone rubble. Great banks of nettles grow here, rich and green. Ash trees rise in lacy fists, and the fields fall away each side. It is very quiet. He hears the ticking of a robin somewhere, like falling water. This place is soundly cursed against man, he thinks. The stink of the dead sheep he found dumped in a drain is still caught in his nose, a sorry, sodden wreck of fleece, pullulating with maggots. He does not mind the smell. It is a bracing stench. It is the smell of mortality. Mm. He looks down at the rabbit-crop turf. Beneath him, the people that lived and died and were buried here are here still, he thinks. Their old bones would be grateful to see a goshawk again. He walks around the chapel, imagining the earth beneath him turning and muttering as it senses the familiar hawk above, as the bones of farm labourers mutter when agricultural machinery passes over their tombs. White's visit to Chapel Green was my favourite part of the goshawk when I was young. It was a communion with something lost and forgotten, and somehow a hawk was at the heart of it. It always gave me a sense of kinship with White, though I couldn't imagine why farmers should have special knowledge of elevators. There's a little section I've run out which talks about how farmers understand elevators, and I thought he meant, you know, lift elevators, not grain elevators, you know. But I could imagine the chapel quite clearly when I was small, and now it was clearer than ever. If I shut my eyes, I saw White lifting Goss on his fist and shutting his own eyes very tight, as if it were possible for the whole mess of the 20th century to slip aside and the world of centuries before be resurrected, a lost community with him at its heart. He would have been loved. He would have been understood.
Mm. That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
The phrase that really jumps out at me is the smell of mortality, because it's kind of there all through the book as you're dealing with your father's death. That's so poignant to hear. So there's a very sad end to Goss, because one of the things you have to learn to do, which is hard for a non-falconer to understand, is you have to learn to let the hawk go, because it has to return to you. You have to trust.
That's the best falconry.
Of course, but the scariest thing too, right? And Goss didn't come back. He lost Goss.
Well, Goss was really interesting. Goss, it wasn't even that he got to the point where he felt he could let Goss free.
Goss
come
to
back
Bob.
Because he was only half trained. And at this point in the book, you begin to realize that there's kind of the only way this book is going to end is if the hawk dies or he does. There's no way out of this pitched battle between the two. That's just him basically sort of punching himself in a mirror. The hawk almost isn't there. He sees himself as this bird, and he's trying to civilize it at the same time as wanting to be wild, and it's just a nightmare. So what he does is, and I'm giving away spoilers here, he ties the hawk to its perch with this very, very, very easily broken twine to try and give it more room to sort of fly around in this sort of small space. And all the way through the book, he's talked about how brittle and how easily broken this twine is. And you think, oh, no. And, of course, the hawk breaks the twine and takes off. And the worst thing about this is that if a hawk breaks free like that, with all this stuff hanging down from it, it's not going to survive. It's going to get tangled up and die. And that is the end of that bit of the book. And I think it's a deeply sad, particularly when he sees the hawk circling in the distance and you think, oh, it's got a death sentence attached to its legs. And, in fact, many years later, I met a man who'd met a gamekeeper from those woods who said he found a skeleton of a hawk all bound up with bits of leather and string in bush.
Oh, my gosh.
So, why, you know, that was Goss.
You know, Helen, I don't think there are any spoilers to your book.
No, that's true, yeah. Everyone dies.
It wouldn't.
Can I just say, I shouldn't really mention, but on Goodreads, the internet site, a friend of mine is on it and sent me this little question someone had asked. And the question was, I know her father dies, but does the hawk die? And someone had answered it, everyone dies.
That's what I said, the smell of mortality is. But when you think about, you know, so White was working out all sorts of things in his psyche with this hawk, and you were too. And I love the phrase you said, you know, letting the hawk go is retraining the heart. That your descriptions of those moments when you get to the point with Mabel where you have to let her go, you know, they're terrifying. They're like death.
They are, and they're, I mean, it's a sort of, you know, any sort of psychoanalysts in the audience are going to kind of, you know, roll their eyes and go, you know, this is all attachment theory, right? So, I mean, these birds, the longer I live with this hawk, the more time I spent with it, the more I felt like it was part of who I was, it was part of me. And when you take that risk and let the hawk go, part of you goes with it. I mean, I would say in the book, it's like if anyone's read the Philip Pullman books, The Dark Materials, it's a demon. Mabel was my demon. She was part of my soul at this point. So it was a very intense experience. But it was also kind of, every time she came back, it made me feel that all was not lost. And that was a big deal for me.
So that was, I mean, she's coming back. She's coming back to you. You said of White, is it true of yourself, or is it just true of training any hawk that you have to convince the hawk that you're not the enemy?
Yeah, this picture here is, you know,
you're still the enemy.
People sometimes say, were you frightened of that hawk? And I'm like, no, she was terrified of me. The whole way you train a hawk is through positive reinforcement. And it's done. You know, they're not social animals. You can't even punish them if you wanted to. I mean, punishment is a very bad way to train any animal. You just persuade it initially that you're a good thing by giving it gifts of steak. This works a bit for people as well, I've discovered. you need to cook that. But it's done all through gifts of food, and eventually the hawk really looks forward to seeing you. So that's kind of how.
Do you have the photo of Mabel on Helen's fist?
Oh, because God, I never thought those trousers would either see the light of day.
Because if you read from on page 182, it'll give you a sense of what training Mabel felt and looked like.
So yes, yeah, so this is me training her on a créance. There's lots of great Norman French words in falconry, and a créance is basically, as my father used to delight in saying, a bit of string. it's actually very, very high strength breaking strain woven cotton. And I'm at this point asking her to fly to me for food and over about 40 yards. And as soon as she hits 50 yards, instantly, as soon as I raise my fist up, then I let her go free. And then comes the next step, which is, of course, letting the bird do what they do in the wild, which is hunt. I hadn't really thought it through, had I, really? I mean, you know, here I am running away from death as fast as possible because the hawk represented life to me, right? This sort of inhuman, bright, kind of fierce life. And yet what goshawks do more than any other hawk is murder stuff. And I knew that would happen. And I'm going to read this bit, which is, I guess it's the bit where she catches her first thing, which is a very intense experience in all sorts of ways. I'd never read this out either. This is all very exciting, reading this bit out. Okay. I don't normally think about things in this way. I was kind of broken at the time, and my identity was in total flux. So don't worry, I don't walk down the street thinking this kind of thing normally. The next day out on the hill, Mabel learns, I suppose, what she is for. She chases a pheasant. It crashes into the brambles beneath a tall hedge. She lands on top of the hedge, peering down. I will do that. When I talk about Mabel, I tend to do the action.
Oh, that's good.
So I'll start flapping my wings probably soon. She lands on top of the hedge, peering down, her plumage bright against the dark earth of the further slope. I start running. I think I remember where the pheasant has gone. I convince myself it was never there at all. I know it is there. Clay sticks to my heels and slows me down. I'm in a world of slowly freezing mud, and even the air seems to be getting harder to run through. Mabel is waiting for me to flush the pheasant, if only I knew where it was. Now I'm at the hedge trying to find it, constructing what will happen next scenarios in my head. And at this point, they're narrowing fast towards point zero, when the pheasant will fly. I cannot see my friends Stuart and Mandy anymore, though I know they must be there. I'm crashing through brambles and sticks, dimly aware of the catch and rip of thorns in my flesh. And now I can't see the hawk because I'm searching for the pheasant. So I have to work out what she is doing by putting myself in her mind. And so I become both the hawk in the branches above and the human below. The strangeness of this splitting makes me feel I'm walking under myself and sometimes away from myself. And then for a moment, everything becomes dotted lines. And the hawk, the pheasant, and I, merely elements in a trigonometry exercise, each of us labelled with the soft italic letters. And now I'm so invested in the hawk and the pheasant's positions that my consciousness cuts loose entirely, splits into one or the other. I've lost. First the hawk looking down, second the pheasant in the brambles looking up, and I move along the ground as if I couldn't possibly affect anything in the world. There is no way I can flush this pheasant. I'm not here. Time stretches and slows. There's a sense of panic at this point, a little buffet of fear that's about annihilation and my place in the world. But then the pheasant is flushed, a pale and burring chunk of muscle and feathers, and the hawk crashes from the hedge toward it. And all the lines that connect heart and head and future possibilities, those lines that also connect me with the hawk and the pheasant and with life and death, suddenly become safe, become tied together in a small muddle of feathers and gripping talons that stand in mud in the middle of a small field, in the middle of a small county, in a small country on the edge of winter. Shall I go on?
Yeah, just read the last paragraph. So beautiful.
It's kind of still emotional to read this, actually. I stare at the hawk as she grips the dead pheasant and her mad eyes stare right back at me. I'm amazed. I don't know what I expected to feel. Bloodlust? Brutality? No, nothing like that. There are thorn scratches all over me from where I dive through the hedge and an ache in my heart I can't place. There's a sheeny fog in the air, dry like talc. I look at the hawk, the pheasant, the hawk, and everything changes. The hawk stops being a thing of violent death. She becomes a child. It shakes me to the core. She is a child, a baby hawk that's just worked out who she is, what she's for. I reach down and start, unconsciously as a mother helping a child with her dinner, plucking the pheasant for the hawk, with the hawk. And when she starts eating, I sit on my heels and watch her eat. Feathers lift, blow down the hedge, and catch in spiders' webs and thorn branches. The bright blood on her toes coagulates and dries. Time passes. Venison of sunlight. A wind shifts the thistle stalks and is gone. And I start crying soundlessly. Tears roll down my face. For the pheasant, for the hawk, for Dad and all his patients, for the little girl who stood by a fence and waited for the hawks to come. So just to butt in there, everything the hawk caught, she ate and I ate. There was nothing.
She ate and you ate.
Well, obviously I cooked my bit.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
I made a mean pheasant pad Thai, guys.
One of the things that was your father's message to you as a young girl was so often was about patience, was about waiting, and there was that beautiful passage in the beginning when as a young girl you, I can't believe your parents let you go, off with these Tweety falconers. You were like, how old?
It was different times, you know. No, actually, they had actually checked them out quite carefully before.
Okay, because it seemed like they just kind of drove off and left you there.
So when I was a small child, I met some people from the British Falconers Club, and this is what's so great about the kind of unreliable narrator or the unreliability of what it's like when you're small. I was going to go hawking with these guys. I was going to see them fly goshawks, and I met them, and I'm like, these guys are like me. I'm one of them, right? I was 12. I was a knock-kneed Surrey schoolgirl from a working-class family. These guys, they weren't like that. No. They were very posh. They were very old. They wore a lot of tweed. They drove Range Rovers. They offered me snuff. I mean...
But they didn't mind that you were a girl and
no,
not a boy.
No.
So they didn't, even though Falcon, it's the 19th century
well, I
Falconers.
Think, I think they probably did mind, but they were gentlemen.
They were gentlemen. They were gentlemen.
Yeah.
Because even hawks were described in the 19th century as like thought of as like hysterical women, right? So that's why you man a hawk. I thought.
Right. So this is the thing about goshawks that I learned slowly as this went on. I had this, this notion that they were kind of half feathered shotguns. And half the mad woman in the attic, right? I mean, they really were portrayed as these hysterical, frightening creatures that would just get into moods, and then they'd go sit up at trees and they'd ignore you, or they'd become hysterical, or some days you just want to kind of pull their heads off because they're so infuriating. And I read all these Victorian books about goshawks a little later as I was training Mabel and realised that all these guys were pretty much talking about women, not hawks. Hormonal women, right? They always said that their hawk's moods were due to some kind of deficiency in the hawk rather than what they had done.
So interesting.
Yeah.
And when that guy says to you, well, obviously you and Mabel get each other because you're both female, you completely, you were really...
I'm like, she's a bird. That's probably more of an issue than her being female, right?
But going back to this idea of patience,
not married anymore, thank goodness. Let you know that.
That couple. But there's that great description when you go on one of those trips as a 12-year-old, when you first see what happens. So you're out with these men, these tweedy men with a snuff, and then one by one they go like, "Oh, just go on without me," because why? They're hawks.
Right. That is true. They're hawks set up trees.
And they were just like they might have to wait for.
I say in the book that it's sort of had that kind of Edwardian polar exploration vibe. These hawks were renowned for sitting up trees. If you really annoy a goshawk, it will just go and sit up a tree, and you can't get it down. And these guys were like, no, you go on. they didn't do that, but it was kind of like that. You go on, I will just slow you down. So I learned that goshawks could be recalcitrant.
So much of your book is also just about paying attention.
Yeah.
Bird watching is a kind of paying attention, but there's a different kind of... And I was thinking, maybe the most focused I've ever been or the closest I've ever felt with a bird was drawing one, like drawing an egret, really zeroing in. But when you talk about that with the hawk... the close attention is you actually were becoming. What you describe, that splitting is a paying attention of a completely. Maybe it's over the other side.
I think it's a matter of degree, though, and I'm very interested that you said that attention came from drawing a bird.
And think about George Archibald with the cranes. He danced. This biologist danced with the cranes. So he was he was being, you know, one of the birds in a
certain way. I'm trained as a historian of science, and one of the things I love about working in the history of science is realizing how much stuff, how much emotional stuff is there when the scientists study animals that isn't allowed to be in the papers that they write.
Oh, that's why one of our favorite authors here is Amy Parrish, who is a bonobo expert, and she studies them mainly in zoos. But she told me that after she had her baby, she took her baby to show the bonobos in the zoo, and one of them immediately ran over to get her baby to show Amy.
Do you know my favorite one? Like, this is completely nothing to do with hawks at all.
Yeah.
Was that I don't know if this is true or not, but it was one of those extraordinary 1960s. Teach the gorillas to speak English through sign language kind of thing, or speak American sign language. And one of the gorillas kept asking...
Coco.
Didn't want a baby, but wanted a kitten.
Wanted a kitten.
And they went, are you sure you don't want a baby? And she was like, I want a black kitten with no tail. And they were like, are you sure you don't want...
Sorry, we got onto mammals here, but...
I'm completely lost now about paying attention. Yeah, because I was obsessed with drawing birds when I was small. As I said, it was a part of conjuring. And still now, I when I look at a landscape, I'm always blocking out color values. I kind of.
But are you doing it from memory, or are you doing it from actually drawing it from the bird?
Both,
being
I do both. Both. So when, but any, I mean, this thing about becoming an animal. I'm sure any of you who've kept any animals at all. I mean, maybe not goldfish or, you know, I reckon you can do it with a turtle. Maybe with goldfish, I don't know. The more you watch an animal, the more you can get inside its head, the more you can sort of understand what it's doing. And there's a lot of really interesting work in ethology, animal behavior studies that talk about this, like how you need to develop an eye for the animal, and you do that by just spending hours and hours and hours watching it. And the more you watch, the more you see. And you do that with dogs and cats, etc. But the problem with me is that I didn't want to be me anymore, and I wanted to be this bird, and I didn't see any of my friends or my family. All I had was this bird that was my model. And pretty soon I started to put myself inside its head to the point where I forgot me. And it sounds really overblown now, but you know what? Towards the end of that time, I mean, I was flying her for hours every day. I was covered in sort of mud and thorn scratches, and you know, I had sort of rabbit blood all over my trousers and didn't wash my hair. And I thought it was, you know, I was in this brutal, beautiful place with her. And I started to get really unwell. I mean, my mental health was nosediving, and I didn't notice. So I'd wake up in the middle of the morning, and my pillow would be soaking wet. I'd have been crying all night from grief, but I didn't know I was grieving because I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't letting myself feel it. I remember one really dark moment when there was a kind of knock on the door, and it was the mailman, and I found myself hiding behind my sofa.
Well, you were also sleeping in a box.
Well, only once did I sleep in a box. Oh, I really am bringing it out.
Let's get that straight.
I was really broken, but my life with the hawk was so compelling and real for me and raw that was my refuge. And it took a while for me to work out that I'd made this daft mistake that T.H.
And there's a beautiful rise in the arc at the end, in the magic chapter, when you talk about, you know, just this glorious, you know, when you're hunting with Mabel, it's like the light has come back in. It's so beautiful. But before since you mentioned... this segue to here, but you know, your family also went through this grief for your father.
Yeah.
You mentioned your mom and your brother in the book. They're not big presences. They're there. How did they react to your, you know, when you first gave them the book? I mean, you must have been. Did they read it in stages?
It was quite scary.
I bet.
I mean, I guess I want to just say now that, you know, writing a memoir is a very strange thing. You have to be remorselessly honest in it.
And you are.
About your own. But there are some things that you don't put in. And I made some big decisions when I started the book. And one of them was that my father was a very private person. And
he was a photographer.
He was a press photographer for a very good one. A lot of his pictures are quite famous. And he always said to me, I want my pictures to be my legacy. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to go on and on about him in the book. I want it to be, you know, respect that. And ditto my mum and my brother, who were still alive. We're very close. But I didn't want them to be... I didn't want to tell their stories for them. With the result that many people think that I just ignored them totally for 6 months, you know. You horrible woman, you're so self-absorbed. I just didn't put them in the book, you know. It was difficult. I said to my mum and my brother, I'm writing this book about... It's mainly about training the hawk and about being very sad. But it's also going to be a bit about losing dad. And it's, you know, it's tough. So would you like to read it chapter by chapter as I write it? And both of them were like, no, just write it. I think they just thought I would never do it. I'm famous for never finishing anything. They just thought, oh, this isn't going to happen, you know. And I finished it, and I sent it to my mother and brother. I printed out a big hard copy on sort of, for some reason, pale blue paper. I thought that would be, maybe that would, like, calm them down or something. And my brother read it all, and he said, it's great, you know, don't, you know, it's fine. And then Mum read the first two chapters. The second one is about my father's death, and it's very tough, and she didn't read it. She put it down and didn't read it for about 3 weeks, and I thought, well, this is it. I've got to return my advance. The book's not going to happen. And I was really like, you know, okay, that's absolutely fine. I'll have to go and work in a cafe or something. I mean, I really was fine. And then one day she picked it up early, late in the small hours. She couldn't sleep, and she read the whole thing. And she rang me up at about 7 in the morning and said, don't change a bloody word. And I cried my eyes out.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. I know you don't see falconry as a sport the way some of those men in the Tweed did, but you see it as more as a mode of conservation awareness, right? That it's a way to understand the habitat, to be close to these animals.
It's very much part of that, yes.
And I bring that out just because a point that comes out again and again in your writing. And some of this is from Helen's columns in the New York Times Magazine, which range more wildly on subjects about animals in the world. You write that the wild can be human work. Mm. And I thought that was so interesting. You write about the British falconers bringing the goshawks back to Britain after they were nearly extinct. You've written about raptor rehabilitators. I don't know if you know that here in Los Angeles we have a mountain lion in our largest urban park.
And I think I've seen the photos. Amazing.
And it means a lot to people. Yes. I mean, it's very improbable. We don't know how long he'll be able to survive there. Yeah. He's already eaten a koala bear.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
He got into the zoo.
But it was, like, really tangy with all those eucalyptus things in it. Like,
it was a bit...
whiskers kind of... Ugh.
But you have such a gift of making these bridges between the animals and human world.
This is the deepest theme. I mean, you know, the very deep theme in this book is life and death and reconciliation, trying to reconcile death with life. I mean, that's kind of... I guess it's the theme of everything that, you know, gets written, I guess, really. But the other theme is how we relate to the natural world. And that big mistake that both T.H. White and I made was to see nature as a mirror of ourselves, specifically to see the hawk as all we wanted to be and see the hawk as ourselves. So I saw the hawk as this self-possessed, solitary creature free from grief that I could become and therefore somehow not have to mourn. And T.H. White saw the hawk as this feral, slightly gay creature that could be slightly sadistic. And he wanted to be this thing untrammeled by human mores and society. And of course, both of these things we're just birds. I mean, when it is all said and done, I mean, a goshawk is pretty impressive, but it's just a chicken with talons. I mean, I don't know if you can see that last picture of Mabel up on the screen.
The third one?
The third picture. I mean, she's kind of like a chicken, right? I mean, obviously not, but that by the way, that 1 foot up is a sign of relaxation in a bird. I once used to work at a falconry centre. People would come in and say, why do you have so many one-legged hawks? Yeah. Anyway, Mabel. So I guess I wanted to sort of get across in the book that everything we think about the natural world, even though there's a beautiful, thriving, exquisitely complex world of non-human things out there, everything we think about it is about us, to a greater or lesser extent. And that seems to me the most important thing to think about that there is now. We're living in really dark times.
And we don't, I mean, it's not like you have to go far away to find nature, to appreciate nature. We have some Vos swifts that come every year in downtown Los Angeles, although I don't know how long that chimney will be there. I mean, it's kind of part of the loss of habitat. But the phrase that really jumped out at me was you said, the whole reason for the stories we invent about ourselves is to exclude others, people who are not like us. And these so often filter through the landscape. And you're talking about these bridges between, you know, you're observing the animal world, and then you're able to make these beautiful leaps into other things that are happening in the world. And I thought a really lovely way to enter, to end which could be a discussion that could go on all night because it's so much fun, is if you would read from this column, the end of the column in the New York Times Magazine, which is called The Human
The Human Flock.
The Human Flock.
Guess what? Do you think I've ever read this before out loud?
No.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying
it. Good, good.
So this is a column I wrote for a while about... I'm going to be doing features for them now, which is very exciting. But I wrote this column for a year. And this one is about flocks and about particularly being in Hungary and watching these vast flocks of common cranes coming down to roost in lakes.
And you're in Hungary, right?
I'm in Hungary, yeah. Okay. And also talking a bit about, you know, starling flocks. You've seen those big murmurations.
Everyone know what a murmuration is? It's a beautiful word.
Guys are so erudite and literary.
It's a library.
Formed. It's a library, of course. So there was that great bit of video last year of someone saw a flock of starlings in New York City that somehow at one instant morphed into Vladimir Putin's face. You know, is it real? Is it not real? Oh, I don't know. Okay, here we go. I'll stop to... It starts with some science stuff, so here we go. The changing shape of starling flocks comes from each bird copying the motions of the six or seven around it with extreme rapidity. Their reaction time is less than a tenth of a second. Mm. Terns can propagate through a cloud of birds at speeds approaching 90 miles an hour, making murmurations look from a distance like a single living, pulsing organism. In a 1799 notebook entry, Samuel Taylor Coleridge wrote of a murmuration that shaped itself into various forms and moved, quote, like a body unendued with voluntary power, unquote. Mm. Sometimes they seem uncannily like an alien, groping entity, living sand or smoke moving through a suite of topological changes. Murmurations are thrilling, but they can also provoke... here we go. Whoa, no! Oh, I've done the thing! An emotion akin to fear. I've just realised...
It's all there, Helen.
...that I've read the wrong bit. You've got some information there that I wasn't going to tell anyone, but now you know it. So I'm now going to, with great shame and embarrassment, move to the bit that I should have been...
It's a good part, because I was sad about losing that part. So you're going to go from...
Okay. I never do this. It must be a sort of a testament to how relaxed I am in front of you all. Thank you. Okay, we're back in Hungary now, moving swiftly. And it's nearly dark and the cranes are coming in. Is my face bright red? I think it is. It is nearly dark now at the Hortobágy fish ponds and my ears ring with the cacophony of calling cranes. There is boiling confusion over the lake as flocks come from all directions to join the mass on the water that now looks like stippled particulate fog. White-fronted geese are pouring in too, tumbling and sideslipping from the sky through swathes of other wings. Suddenly, it's almost too much to bear. Big flocks of birds can leave you uncomfortably disoriented. One birder told me that his experience of watching flocks of rooks at nightfall was so confusing and noisy that it produced in him something like motion sickness. In search of something solid, I peer through a spotting scope focused on the far side of the lake. And in the circle of the viewfinder, the confusion resolves into individual birds. It's so dark that their colour has leached away. I'm watching stately groups of cranes in grayscale, landing, drinking, shaking their loose feathers, greeting one another, and getting on with the business of finding a place to sleep. This switch in recognition is eerie. I go from seeing rushing patterns in the sky to the realization they're made of thousands of beating hearts and eyes and fragile frames of feather and bone. I watch the cranes scratching their beaks with their toes and think of how the starling flocks that pour into reed beds like grain turn all of a sudden into birds perching on bowed stems, bright-eyed, their feathers spangled with white spots that glow like small stars. I marvel at how confusion can be resolved by focusing on the things from which it's made. The magic of the flocks is the simple switch between geometry and family. And as I stand there observing the cranes, my mind turns to more human matters. It's been nagging away at me all the time I've been here, the razor wire fence that the government has erected more than 100 miles south of here to stop Syrian refugees walking across the border from Serbia. The thought of crowds moving slowly northeast as the cranes move southwest. And watching this flock has brought home to me how easy it is to react to the idea of masses of refugees with the same visceral apprehension with which we greet a cloud of moving starlings or tumbling geese, to view it as a singular entity, strange and uncontrollable and chaotic. But the crowds coming over the border are people just like us, perhaps too much like us. We do not want to imagine what it would be like to have our familiar places reduced to ruin. In the face of fear, we are all starlings, a group, a flock made of a million souls seeking safety. I love the flock not just for its biological exuberance, but for the way it prompted me to pick similarity out of strangeness, for the way its chaos was transformed upon reflection to individuals and small family groups wanting the simplest things, freedom from fear, food, a place to safely sleep.
I'm going to open it up in just a second. I just want to say you have such a remarkable gift of making those almost like the murmurations, you know, from the human world into the animal world. I mean, I just feel like your writing is just amazing, shape-shifting. Wow. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So much. Thank you. So we'll circulate microphones if you raise
your hand. Oh, we have roving mics. I love
this. We have roving mics.
I always feel like I'm one of those TV game shows from the 1970s. I had a five-year-old boy once ask me what the biggest thing Mabel ever murdered was.
And what was it?
Well, I thought about it, and I said, I think it was a big rabbit. And he was so disgusted with me that he actually blanked me for the rest of the evening. I think he thought I was going to say a horse or something. He was very disappointed. He was very disappointed with that.
Questions right over here.
Hello.
Hi. You write at the beginning of the book, when you're first getting Mabel, about another bird.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, because it sounded like a really unique, bizarre, overwhelming experience.
Yeah, so I bought Mabel off the internet. This sounds worse than it was. I knew the man who bred her. He was a very dedicated goshawk breeder. All the birds of prey used in Britain are bred in captivity in Falkland, none taken from the wild.
But Gos was taken from the wild.
Gos was, because in the 30s, everyone took birds from the wild. No one had bred them in captivity before. So, yeah, so I drove up to Scotland, to Stranraer. Has anyone been to Stranraer? Oh, my goodness, someone has been to Stranraer. Almost, it's more like, it's even more unlike LA than Cambridge is. This guy came with these two boxes, as you know, and one of them had Mabel in to be, and one of them had this other bird that was actually, it turned out, the one I was supposed to have. So he gets Mabel out of the box to check these government ring numbers, and I'm like, it's Mabel, and I'm astounded, and I'm in love, in a non-romantic way, obviously. And I know that's my bird, and he puts it back. Oh, he says, oh, no, that's not the right one, and he gets the other bird out. And our eyes meet, and there's nothing there. And it makes this weird wailing noise, and I'm like, no. I got really scared. I'm like, this is not my hawk. And I ended up having this, you know, big pleading thing with him on the quayside. I say it's like a sort of seaside production of Medea, you know. I'm no. And eventually he said yes, and I was very happy, and I brought Mabel home, and she was an eerily generous, kind, and calm hawk. They're meant to be these thrillingly frightening wild things, and she was a total sweetheart from day one. And I found out that the other bird that I should have had was almost untrainable.
Wow.
It was a complete disaster. And the guy that was trying to train it was this very calm guy, and he just... It made him very, very down and very depressed. And eventually he thought, this bird's going into an aviary as a breeding bird because I can't do this. And I think I really dodged a bullet there. I think if I'd got that bird, I honestly don't know if I'd be here today. I think it would have been the darkest of experiences.
Good question.
So, yeah, thank goodness that happened.
Over here.
I'm a falconer. I fly a female Finnish goss.
Wow, who bred her?
She's bred here in the United States. She's 16.
Right.
I've been a falconer for 18 years.
Excellent.
My husband never got it. And as a falconer, it's a way of life.
It is.
And, you know, he just had to put up with it.
And this is that thing where I just want to grab you and go and talk goshawks with you now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
I brought pictures. anyway, he finally read your book. He's got it.
What? I get all emotional.
It changed him. He said, do you think that I could hold Duchess on my fist? Do you think that I could handle her? Would you let me? He asked me permission.
And so is that good, though?
It's wonderful.
I'm so
wonderful.
Pleased. That's one of the greatest things I've ever heard. I mean, it's one of those things where I hear that and my little heart goes, it was worth writing the book.
And I have to tell you, it's a prerequisite to be my friend. They have to read your book.
So, I like this lady.
Do you have a question?
Otherwise, they don't understand. They don't understand.
Okay, I think that thing about only questions, that rule is completely doesn't count with that one, because that was amazing. Thank you so much. That was amazing. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you later. Absolutely. Oh, here we are.
Can you talk about how it felt after you lost Mabel, which you just make a very quick reference to at the very end of the book?
Yeah, Mabel died of, you'll know, there's a disease called aspergillosis, which has been the bane of goshawkers for centuries. It kills a lot of wild birds, too. And it's this horrible kind of airborne fungal infection of the lungs that kills birds incredibly quickly, acute, and it's acute form. And, I cried. I cried buckets. I miss her. I miss her an awful lot, you know. It's a bit like dogs. There's the one bird. And I flew her for 6 years, and I wanted to keep flying her for another, you know, God knows how long. And, you know, they live quite a long time. And but it was a very simple kind of grief. You know, Mabel taught me an awful lot of things about, and my father's passing did too, about that, how that boundary between life and death is very, very small, and none of us are here long. And you know, when you go hunting with a hawk, it's a very intense experience, and you realize that everything's trying to stay alive as long as possible, and sometimes that doesn't happen because a hawk catches it. So, you know, and also she wasn't my dad, right? I mean, she was a bird. So I just miss her dreadfully. I wish she'd been around longer. But I think that that year with her taught me that none of us, in a sense, are here very long. And, yeah, I'm just sad she's not here anymore. Oh, no, okay. Anyone else?
Late in the book, when you're more available to the gifts of mourning, you look back on Westminster Bridge, and that was part of a moment. Can you help me? Can you help me see that part of it?
When I'm on Westminster Bridge?
Well, you look back and you look at it, and it's part of the moment, and there was some meaning for you or some connection to your father.
There's a bit early on in the book where I look over at the Thames.
I don't think so.
No. There's a bit in his memorial where...
Yes.
There's a reading by someone reads lines composed on Westminster Bridge, the Wordsworth poem, at his memorial. And that was a very intense experience. I don't remember much really apart from the fact that it was that poem that was read, that great romantic musing on London. My father grew up in London during the Blitz. He was not a particularly literary man, but he loved that poem. And the man that read it was someone who used to work with him, who ended up becoming politically very powerful later in his life, and sort of renowned as... I don't know if you ever saw that there's an English poem called The Thick of It. And there was another kind of... There's a guy in it, Peter Capaldi, plays this foul-mouthed kind of political operator based on this guy, right? And this guy stood up in my dad's memorial and said, you know, Alistair was a good man. And then read this poem. And I think it was that sort of moment of great lyrical beauty and great romantic kind of beauty in that poem about human life and mutability and fallibility and mortality and the city that just broke me. So, yeah, it's an astonishing poem if you've not read it. Thank you. Sorry, I'm asking.
I read your remarkable book two times, and the second time I was able to just enjoy the language so much, even more than the first time, and I was struck with the question because you move so effortlessly, at least in the draft that we're reading, and I'm so interested in your writing process, between Mabel and your recovery from this grief and the details surrounding your relationship with your father and patience and White. And I wonder, did that just all come to you magically, how to weave all of this together? Or
it was
did your
hard
editor
work.
Or friends make suggestions? Or how did that come?
Okay, so I think one of the things that's interesting to talk about there is the difference between the sort of writing culture in Britain and here. I've become really interested in this. It certainly seems that the whole idea of a book being workshopped and having a lot of you meet with your editor and you discuss what it's going to happen and what's going to happen in it. And I did it in the old-fashioned way. I just said, I'm writing this book, guys, and I just disappeared for 2 years. Yeah. That's quite a dangerous thing, I think, in many ways. But what it did was let me be... I think I broke a lot of rules without realizing I was breaking them. And one of those rules was rules to do with genre. I wanted to bring together nature writing and literary biography and grief memoir and all sorts of things in ways that I thought was interesting. Partly because I wanted those narratives and those genres to crash into one another and start splintering, because one of the things that happens after a big grief, as you'll know, is all the stories you tell yourself about yourself and the way the world works start to kind of splinter and disintegrate. So I wanted that confusion. And I wanted T.H. White to be in it, but I didn't know he'd be so much in it until I went to Texas and went to the archives and began to be quite haunted by his story and see how it was like mine but not mine. But actually weaving those things together was really interesting. It was kind of like... like doing a really difficult crossword puzzle, but it was also like training a hawk. Now, that sounds really ridiculous, but I mean, I hadn't done a big book before, written a big book. And after about 3 or 4 chapters, I started to realize that the book was starting to kind of push back at me. It was like kind of trying to lead a horse somewhere, and it's like, you know. Or some days the horse is galloping really fast, and you're like, I don't know where we're going. The book started to tell me what should and what shouldn't be in it. And every morning I used to have to read the book from the beginning to where I'd got to and then keep writing. This was quite easy to start with. Towards the end of the book, it got quite time-consuming, but it was really what I needed to keep the shape of it in my head before I could continue, and that was really, really important. But having said that, I edited a lot. I mean, I edited as I went along. So I would go over paragraphs again and again and again until I could move to the next one. And I kind of just did it like that. So, yeah, it was weird. Weird process.
I was also remarking to Helen that the difference between listening to the book, have you listened to the audiobook, is real. It's so different, because the segues between sometimes talking about her life with Mabel and, like, you don't really know quite where they are. So it's more, to me, it was much more of a surreal experience. Like, the edges between the braided things were a lot less. They were even more fluid than when you see them on the page. But they're beautifully. It's a very complicated.
It was a really weird thing to do, that audiobook. It was 4 days of talking for 7 hours a day.
It's so good.
I can't drink raw honey to keep my voice.
Recommend it too highly.
Thank you. Thanks. Really good question.
This is kind of a hard question to ask, but a lot of us have dealt with grief. And I was wondering, what compelled you to deal with grief through training a hawk, primarily?
Yeah.
Was it your experience as a child, so that by going back, you felt you were reconnecting with the father of your childhood? Because to me, there's something inherently bizarre about choosing a murderous animal to deal with grief.
I think fair enough is my response.
And I loved the book, by the way. I read it and I listened to it. And I loved the T.H. White story, right. And I'm listening to Once and Future King. But that was really my main question. What was it that drew you to that as a way of dealing with your grief?
I knew it was a way of making myself disappear. I mean, that's the most simple way of putting it. I think I found who I was unbearable. I found thinking about what had happened unbearable. I knew that in training a hawk, it would be an enormous distraction, and I knew that it would make me invisible to myself, and I could be more. I would that the hawk. I have a friend that he said to me when he's very drunk, which he doesn't do often. He swears. He puts the heel of his hand to his head if he feels sick, and then he presses really hard until all he can feel is the heel of his hand on his forehead, and that stops him thinking that he feels sick. And it was kind of a bit like that with the hawk. The hawk was the heel of the hand on my forehead. But having said that, I mean, yes, why a goshawk? And I think, you know, we were talking about this earlier, about how we routinely use animals as ways of saying things that we can't say out loud. I was talking to a psychoanalyst recently in a non-professional capacity. We were having coffee. And he's a lovely guy, incredibly renowned chap, and he was saying he had a woman, he is one of his clients, obviously he didn't give me her name, and she brings a dog to the sessions, and she has great problems with talking about how her emotional state, she doesn't like to confess how she feels about anything, which makes the whole process of analysis quite hard. So she sits there, and then she'll talk, and then she'll stop, and she'll say, he'll say something, and then she'll say, my dog is really angry with you, right? And we thought this was absolutely wonderful, because, of course, the therapist knows what's going on. She knows what's going on. The dog hasn't got a clue, obviously. But the dog is a way of her becoming a self that can express some things that she couldn't otherwise do. And I think Mabel, there's a lot of rage caught up in grief. There was for me a lot of anger. And, you know, I think part of it was also that sense that here was an invulnerable, fierce creature that I could have somehow become a bit like a kind of superhero that could fly and, you know, didn't have to deal with it all. So, yeah, I think the goshawk was this kind of alternative self. You know, I could have drunk a lot or taken drugs or had inadvisable affairs. I mean, all those other things, ways of obliterating one's sense of who one is, were also available. I mean, it could have been one of those, but it was a goshawk, right? My mother and my brother were like, of course it was. So, but it's a really good question. Thank you. It's really good.
Time for one more question?
Oh, no, this is...
Maybe we do two more.
Hi. Thank you for your relaxed state. It relaxed all of us, I'm sure. But this goes to the thousands of hours that you've observed aviary flight, and not so much the book. But I just want your take. You know, science is so factual and so hardcore. But... can you explain, or did you magically acquire a feeling of how flocks,
I know what you mean.
How they can do these mosaics all in unison. Mm. Do you know how that might be possible?
Yeah,
something?
It's been... for many, many, many years, people have just, you know, speculated that birds must be telepathic because they turn instantly, you know. And what's astonished scientists studying them is that those waves that propagate through just from a single bird turning and the five or six around it turning instantaneously with the other one copying it, there's no loss in speed across the... they're using the same... math to describe what happens in flocks as they use to describe the liquid helium. I mean, it's extraordinary the kinds of stuff that flocks do.
Real mental processes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just from this thing of birds copying each other and, you know...
But you also talk about fear. Like if a raptor's, the whole...
Yeah, so often you'll see those murmurations, those starling murmurations. You'll see those incredible pulsing patterns. And if you look really carefully at them, you'll often see there's a hawk diving through the flock. And what those rippling patterns are simply birds scared the hell out and trying to get out of the way. So, and I think that's also quite a moving thing to contemplate. Yeah. No, it's a really good question.
Hello.
Hello.
One place you take Mabel is a chalk stream, and then you meet that couple who's seemingly nice at first and then makes a terrible comment. And then you talk about chalk culture and chalk cult. Mm. And I had no idea what that was, and I'd never heard about it. And then looked up and had to look up a picture because I imagined the chalk was like a white stream. But no. It's like a very English-looking setting.
Yeah.
And is it like still, is chalk cult like still a like problem, so to
this
speak?
This is a really lovely question because it is totally baffling to anyone who didn't grow up in England. And you know, one of the things that when my American publisher took on the book, there was a big meeting apparently, and they were like, "Is it a bit too English?" You know, bless them that they decided it wasn't. So yeah, those chalk landscapes. Have you ever seen photographs of Stonehenge? You know, those amazing kind of like bleak grass, be like prairie grasslands, and that's all on chalk. So it looks like, you know, if you dig in the soil, it's white. It's like chalk dust. And those landscapes have definitely come over the last sort of, you know, century or so to stand for a particular kind of nationalist vision of what England is, this sense of ancient England and ancient Britain. And there's some really interesting academic work on this and how they've been used to anchor notions of belonging that are very exclusive, you know. We don't want the foreigners here kind of. And there were some weird proto-fascist cults around the chalk landscapes in parts of England in the 1930s. So, you know, when I'm in this landscape, I kind of aware of all that, but they're still exquisitely beautiful. And I know that pull that I have towards them is caught up in those quite dark histories about who's allowed to be here and who belongs. So this couple that I saw in my mum's village, and you know what, this is so bad because when I wrote this book, I thought no one would read it. I mean,
Surprise. A few people.
And I never thought they'd know about it, right? And they were talking about how we saw this flock of deer. Flock? Herd? Oh, my goodness. And they're talking about this landscape and they're saying, you know, isn't it great that there's still these things here, you know, old England, despite all the immigrants coming in. And I'm just like, oh, what? You know, I didn't really expect that. And I didn't say anything. And that was a great grief that I didn't lose it with them. Because pretty much all the animals that you can see in that landscape were brought to Britain one time or another by people, Romans, you know, Anglo-Saxons.
But that was that great connection between, and thank you for that great question, between that couple and your reading about the fence and Hungary. And
we use it to prove our own notions to ourselves.
Right.
There really aren't chalk cults type little camplets of proto-fascists anymore. But those landscapes, I mean, I do worry about the political situation in Europe at the moment. I mean, it does seem that we're all encouraged to view things with fear, that we are under siege from something, and we use the landscape to kind of motivate quite often that kind of fear, and I find that quite sad. You know, my best friend, Chris Junior, in the book is from Australia, and she, like, you know, she loves the English countryside like it's her own, and she didn't come from here, so. Anyway, really, it's a really important kind of area. I could go on for probably about another 4 hours, but you guys probably would like to
Helen, I
want
to thank you for bringing your heart and your mind and your beautiful language to us, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.